everyone. Welcome to the Advocacy Learning Center's Affinity Discussion. Today we are joined by teams from classes F, G, H, and I. Welcome, I. This is your very first call with us, so we're so glad to have all of you together. My name is Beth McNamara, and I will be the moderator for today's call. This is our third affinity discussion in our three-part series, Exploring Shelter Rules. And as always, we try to design our affinity discussions as free-flowing, kind of active, engaged dialogue. So we have several guests on the line with us and unmuted calls in unmuted lines so that we can all kind of dive in and start talking. And for those of you who have called in today as a participant, we recognize that we've had to balance kind of this fine balancing act of making sure everybody can hear and has the best sound quality possible. And when we leave everybody's line unmuted, it tends to have a little background noise, people eating chips and having, you know, a little whisper of quick things because stuff happens, as we all know, during our days. So we recognize that that creates a little bit of a barrier, but we do want to have you participate as much as possible. So we have an operator on the line, and you can engage in the conversation at any moment by doing one of two things. Talking to the operator to get your line unmuted. You do that by pushing star one. And the other option is to email advocacy@praxisinternational. And I'll try to check that as frequently as possible. And if you want to chime in that way, that is also a good alternative. So without further ado, let's get us rolling. So today we have Priya from Anavi, Liz, Diane, and Sandy from Praxis. And Liz, if you can do your usual quick tech pieces, and then we'll move into the content.
Sure. Thanks, Beth, and hi, everybody. I'll just reiterate what Beth said. We do encourage you to, at any point, don't be shy and dive into our conversation, share in the dialogue with us, and so do that either by getting into the operator queue by pressing star one or sending an email to advocacy@. But really this dialogue, it's an intended as a dialogue, can only really operate in that sort of way by everyone's participation. So we really encourage you to participate and join in our conversation. This session is being recorded, and so if you want to refer to it after the fact, know that it will be available on the Protected ALC class webpage of our website, and so you can look for it there after a few days. And finally, just to let you know, if you do experience any sort of technical issues during the session, the best thing for you to do would be to send an email to me, liz@praxisinternational.org. That's it for me.
Fantastic. All right, thanks, Liz. So we created this series because the issue of shelter rules is one that programs have struggled with for a long time. We heard from a lot of programs over the last several years that this was something that they were struggling with, that they wanted to look at, didn't know where to start, started and then got stymied or, you know, kind of freaked out and then we stopped. So there was just kind of all of this place where people landed in examining shelter rules. So this three-part series started back in May, and we first heard from Anne Menard, who is the executive director of the National Resource Center on Domestic Violence. And she started us out by just giving us a historic perspective on how shelter rules started, along with what she presented as the study that came out that she was a part of on meeting survivors' needs, a multi-state study of DV experiences. And that's really where we started with this digging in and figuring out what it is that was happening, how we got here, and what we were hearing from women about their experiencing staying in shelter. And then on our last call at the beginning of August, we had the Missouri Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence join us. And they started this conversation with us about the project that they started and talked about kind of where this project started in Missouri. The manual that was mailed to everybody at the beginning of this series was their manual, How the Earth Didn't Fly Into the Sun, their project to reduce rules in domestic violence shelters. And so that's kind of where we've taken it thus far for our two-part series. If you weren't able to join us for those two calls or missed one or want to listen to it again, we do have those archived in the recordings of the class protected page of the website, so we encourage you to jump on there and listen to them at your leisure. And so today, for our last series, we have Jennifer and Laura back from the Missouri Coalition. Yay! Welcome, guys. And we also have Dedra Boylan from New Beginnings in Seattle, Washington. And so I'm just going to quickly introduce Jennifer, Laura, and Dedra, just so you know who's talking and their perspective and their background. And then we'll get started with kind of unwrapping our final conversation on how we're going to get to a place where we have this all figured out, nicely wrapped with a little bow.
With a song.
No pressure, huh? All right, so Jennifer Carter, Dr. is with the Missouri Coalition, and she has worked in the movement to end violence against women since 1997. Her experiences in Texas and Missouri include advocating with victims of domestic and sexual violence, research, community organizing, education, and program development in campus and community-based programs. She taught contemporary issues in domestic violence at the University of Missouri School of Social Work as an adjunct professor, and she joined the Missouri Coalition in 2003 as a program development specialist and then became the education coordinator in 2010, and now she is the education and outreach coordinator. Laura Zahand is, it's her birthday today, so it's extra special that she is joining us on her very special day, so thank you, Laura.
You're welcome.
But she's been advocating for survivors of domestic and sexual violence since 1995. She joined the coalition staff in 2003 as the program development specialist and has worked in domestic violence shelters as a children's program coordinator. She went on to be the director of victim services for a dual domestic violence program, DVSV program. And prior to joining the coalition, she was domestic violence victim advocate in a county prosecutor's office. She has served on a number of boards that are active in advocating for children victims of violence and other victims of crime. So welcome, Jennifer and Laura from Missouri. And then we have Dedra Boyland. She is the community advocacy manager at New Beginnings and previously was the longtime shelter manager. She's a part of the original faculty and development team for the Washington State Coalition Against Domestic Violence Shelter Rules Project. As you can see, that's why we got her on this call. And she has trained to several states to train on DV shelter advocates and directors on the philosophy and substance of reducing shelter rules and increasing survivor autonomy and dignity. She has also served as a previous chair of the Washington State Coalition Board of Directors. She's an experienced, warm, funny facilitator and trainer. And as an African-American woman, she has a particular interest and connection to the experiences of women of color who come to our services. So welcome, the three of you. We are very happy to have you with us.
Thank you.
Yeah. So last call, as I did our quick review of our series thus far, last time we got a chance to dive into the Missouri Coalition's experience on looking at shelter rules. And so we didn't get a chance to talk with Dedra about their project. So I thought what we should do first is have Dedra just give us a little introduction about their project at Washington State Coalition and kind of just a little overview, introduction, how it started, all of those pieces.
So this is Dedra Boylan, and I want to just say first that I started at New Beginnings in 1989, but I'm no older than 28, so let's just go there. I started out as a children's advocate, and then I became a woman's advocate. So if anyone knows, that means you do everything in the shelter, including mop, do dishes, clean toilets, fix the roof, call the police, call the ambulance. You do everything. So I have my experience from being in every part of this agency and probably having a position in every part of this agency, which is hilarious in itself. So, but just keep in mind, I'm 28. This project came about when Margaret Hobart and Susan Hannibal, who works for DSHS, the Domestic Violence Program for the DSHS, they started talking about some of the rules that were in shelters. They had did some visits to some of the programs in Seattle, Washington. And a lot of those shelters had a lot of rules in them. And they kind of came back to the table and talked about how the rules were really limiting people and what could be done about that. They also recognized that the rules were not only having some adverse effects on the participants, but they were also affecting the staff as well. So they talked about it and thought they really needed to do some things in the programs to change that. So Margaret came up with some focus groups, and she went to many of the shelters in Seattle and started some focus groups with participants and met with them and asked them questions about the shelter and what, you know, how they got there, what services were they getting out of the program, what was working for them, what wasn't working for them. And she also gave them cameras to take pictures of their environment. She also gave cameras to children. And she allowed them to take pictures of whatever they wanted to take pictures of, what they thought was helpful, useful, a great space, or not so great space. And then they developed those pictures and wrote information next to the pictures about what really worked about that space and what didn't work about that space. And then all that information was given back to the staff so that they could view it and use it to support how they were going to create safe space for participants and more of an atmosphere that was welcoming and engaging and supportive to women and children that were coming into their program. After that, the Building Dignity website came, and that started from advocates who really thought that everyone should have this feedback, not just their programs, but everyone should have that feedback of what is useful in shelters, what's not so helpful in shelters, and just to provide a space where someone is, you know, supported, welcomed, treated with dignity. It's a gracious, gracious space for people to come into and actually connect with advocates and work is getting done. They're not living day-to-day by rules and regulations on what not to do, but it's more about you're welcome in all of this space and it belongs to you. And that's kind of how those things got started. And if you go to the Building Dignity website, you will see that it sort of just pinpoints and explains what those gracious spaces look like and how they can be helpful to everyone. It includes things like kitchen space and how more than one sink can be helpful if you have communal living, or windows in between different areas so that you can see your children playing when you're talking to the advocate. So it just kind of goes through all of those things to support you in making changes in your program that creates that dignity building feeling when you go into a shelter.
Thank you. And I have to say, we'll post the link to the website on our website so people can go and look. But you could lose yourself in this website. The pictures are absolutely beautiful, and the way it's organized is so nice. It's just incredibly helpful. I can't tell you how much information is just packed in here in a way that's useful and helpful, I think, to people. So, but if you're not wanting to wait to go on our website to get the link, I'll just tell you it's buildingdignity.wscadv.org, Washington State Coalition Against Domestic Violence.org.
And it's,
you can go around.
It's a mutual information. So it's information for participants and families to feel comfortable in a program, but it also supports the staff and how the staff has the ability to do their work and do their work effectively because the space is more effective. The environment is more effective.
Yep. And it doesn't give one way to do shelter services, and I think that's what I appreciated, that there was a lot of different perspectives in what was helpful and what was taken into consideration. And so it's not professing that there's one way to create this space. So it's nice. Okay, so as you can tell, now we have three women who have spent a ginormous amount of time examining shelter rules on the call with all of us. And I know because I have talked to many of you who have called me and, you know, over the course of the last couple of years, and most recently once we started this series with, you know, a ton of questions about how we're going to do this, how do we roll up our sleeves and figure this out. So we're at a place where I think it would be, would behoove us to pick these three women's brains to say, what is it that you learned and how can we replicate it? So let's start first by just how we can start exploring shelter rules in our own programs. And maybe Jennifer or Laura, do you want to get us started?
Sure. This is Laura. And I also want to echo, as far as the Building Dignity website, there's so much amazing information. There's actually amazing information throughout the entire Washington State Coalition's website, but I really do like what's there. So I do recommend, you know, along with reading the How the Earth Didn't Fly into the Sun publication, but also really looking at that website. It's always interesting to me that sometimes we forget to ask survivors what works for them, and that really is, along with really working, you know, with advocates and saying what's going to work for you. But ultimately what we're trying to do is, you know, create a program that it can be the best it can be for survivors coming through that door. So as far as where, I know in Missouri what we did was when we brought folks together, we really had them take a look at their mission statements. And was that still their mission statement, and what their services, how they interacted, what their processes, what their policies were, was it still meeting their mission statement? And really looking at what that mission statement meant, what are the core values of the organization? You know, is it still that you do believe that a survivor is their own best expert? You know, are our practices, our policies, all those kinds of things, are they truly, you know, woman defined? Are we looking at the effect of trauma on somebody and how our rules and our might become barriers? I mean, it was really starting to explore and dig down through kind of, okay, why are we here and what are we doing, you know, at the very basic level. And really what came out of those conversations was a whole lot of, well, of course that's still what we believe. Of course that's what we want to do. But the realization that sometimes our policies and our practices weren't following those things. But then there was also this, okay, if we're going to make these changes, how do we get all staff to buy into that? And that became a much bigger issue for some folks. And honestly, where they started though was really bringing staff into those conversations around, okay, let's talk about our rules, let's talk about our practice, let's talk about our policies, let's talk about our interactions. And they really took every single rule, for the most part, that they had. Most of the programs that were with us, they went through every single rule and asked those questions about, why do we have this? Do we need it? What happens if we take it away? I mean, they really and where did it come from, first of all? That was really one of the biggest questions to ask about any rule that was there is, okay, where did this come from? Why is this here?
What one program did that was a larger program is they did like a continuum exercise with the rule as part of that conversation for both a visual and just another tool in discussion. When they'd bring up a rule, they'd ask where people were on the continuum. Did they feel like the rule needed to be in place or not? Did they feel like it was reflecting survivor-defined advocacy or not? And then they used that as a discussion point of why did people pick where they were, again, trying to create that staff buy-in and a shared experience among everyone, because that really is so critical for the implementation. That people really are starting to get it and have those dialogues.
And this is Deirdre. I would say that, you know, we do this work because we're passionate about this work. This is something that we love, we do, we care about. We're vested. We're invested in this work. And if you go to work each day and your mission statement is not guiding your staff or your employees, that's definitely something to look at. People want to know that they're doing the work that is making the difference. And if your mission statement is not guiding you in the work that you do each day, that is something to start with. That is a place to start within your whole agency.
Yeah, I completely agree, Deirdre. This is Beth. It's one of those things that we start talking about in the ALC pretty early on about exploring our mission statement and the importance of it. Because it does carry such power for all of us and why we do what we do and why we come to work every day and why this has, you know, filled our lives.
Right.
And then the
it
other
means
thing.
Something different, I'm sorry. It means something different from some than others because you have those who are out talking about the mission statement every day, like your executive director or your development department. But are your advocates talking about the mission statement? And if they're not, How does it apply to them? So that's why I think it's also important to think about how it works for everyone.
Yep, I agree. And then the other experience that we've had is that when the organization starts kind of diving into this process of looking at policies and shelter rules, you know, we start from this place of just like the three of you have suggested is starting from your mission and going from there, and there are some organizations that have this realization once they get to the second step of everybody has recognized the importance of the mission statement, and it's empowering, and it feels like it fits with why we all do the work that you all do, and then you move to starting to look at rules, the rules that we created within the organization, and it just doesn't match up. It doesn't feel the same, that it doesn't feel empowering any longer, that somehow we've lost that mission within the rules that we've created for organizations. So there's this huge disconnect that suddenly is recognized, and that has been, you know, the experience of what people have brought to me is this realization that this just doesn't match up for us anymore. What do we do about it, and how do we go down that path? And so I love your suggestion of starting to explore all the rules and ask questions about them. From the ALC perspective, you know, we've kind of given you that graphic, the social change advocacy graphic that we have with the core principles of advocacy. And so a great way to go through your shelter rules one by one is to just ask yourself those questions of the core principles. Does this rule create an experience as liberating or dominating, for example? And then you can ask yourselves, yes, no, or maybe. Does it engage in dialogue, or does it counsel or give advice? Does it support engagement? Does it recognize the multiple layers in women's lives? You know, all of those kinds of things. So that would be a great tool, is just a great built-in way to ask questions. You know, kind of frame them up instead of a statement, use them as a question, and you can go down that path of exploration. Okay.
This is
Deirdre.
I just want to add to that. One thing that we discuss, Margaret and I, when we do our training is that to identify rules and program policies, and you have to separate those because in our minds we think a rule technically, we would assume, would mean there's a discussion that's going to be had that might end up in you leaving the program. So if you set fire to the bathroom, that's a rule that we might have to let you go. But if you you know, came in past curfew. Is that really a rule? Is it really something we're going to let you go for? What does that mean? So identifying what might actually get you asked to leave from a program versus what's negotiable will draw that line between your rules and conversations.
Very good. Jennifer, Laura, do you have anything to help distinguish rules versus policies?
Well, I think that, this is Laura, I think one of the things that what we found, and I know when I was working in shelter, what I found were the things that weren't always written down that really became pretty common practice, and it really did become unwritten rules. And again, that whole inconsistency of them, too, sometimes between, you know, depending upon who was on shift, who was working where, you know, that kind of thing, too. I also think that there is, regardless of what the rule says and the policy, that, you know, how that plays out, there is still that third element of the practice of it that I think doesn't always line up with anything else either. So, and there's also what I found very interesting is how many, and I think it has much more to do with, we're talking about communal living situations, but how many programs, not just in Missouri, but across the country and across the world, that everybody seemed to have very similar rules. This was not a phenomena of this certain rule that was happening in whatever location. I mean, there were some real common rules that grew out of domestic violence shelters, regardless of where it was located. And I'm not sure that I was totally surprised by that, but it was kind of fascinating to me that it didn't matter where you were. So the same issues were coming up wherever it was. And how that played out with different policies and practice, that's sometimes where you saw the differences.
Well, this is Jennifer. What one of our programs is currently doing, and they weren't involved in the original project, but they're still implementing philosophy and practice, is, you know, sometimes folks are in crisis and they've got lots of needs they need to attend to, but they're not thinking past what does this exit mean. So what this executive director has started having in the conversation with folks is, you know, really spell out what you're asking. You're asking us to exit somebody into homelessness and that they might be on the street, and has what they've done really justify that? And let's really talk more thoroughly about what the consequences are of them leaving, and shifting that focus. Which is, he's found, has also really helped in their conversation about, it's really got to be something that's causing a serious harm to others. They've explored different resources and options. They've been trying to help this person, that we really need to think about what's the consequence if they've been asked to leave, and what does that mean for that person?
I totally agree with you. This is Deidre, because I think about how if a rule is negotiable and an advocate can negotiate whether that person stays or not, most advocates are going to negotiate for that person to stay because they don't want them to be homeless again. But, you know, who's making those rules, and are advocates feeling safe to follow through with the decisions of behind those rules? Do they feel supported when they make that decision? And they're alone when they make those decisions on what's gonna be the fate of this person. And so when you think about that and you think about the pressure that puts on a staff person or advocate, that's a lot. And that can cause a lot of anxiety and stress. And, you know, you go back to, was it negotiable? Maybe I'll just let her stay. And I think you really have to think about what that rule is and the impact that it's going to have on the individual participant and that staff person when they have to make a decision, and the support they're going to get after they make that decision.
Absolutely. And this is Laura again. And I also, it's interesting to me, if it's negotiable, does it actually have to be written down, put in a handbook? I mean, I think that's the that's the other piece of this, that sometimes it's like when we, because I talk with advocates all the time and executive directors who are like, yeah, we have this rule, but it's just kind of a guideline and we don't really do anything with it. And I'm thinking, then why is it sitting in there? Because somebody reads that and they're going to really look at that sometimes and go, oh, okay, then I've got, this is what happens every time. Yeah.
I say, this is Deidre, I say when you go through all of your rules, cross off everyone that's negotiable. Take it off.
Thank you. Yes, I totally agree.
Yep. I think this is Beth. I think in addition to the negotiable ones, any of those where staff then say, well, that's what the rule says, but this is actually what we do. Like red flag that one, highlight it and circle it. And those are all the places where that's the perfect place to start. Because I think
and
what
also,
we...
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
I also think it's important to make sure you get feedback from every advocate because
mm-hmm.
there might be a rule that one person is very uncomfortable with, but they haven't spoke up about it yet.
Yep.
And you have to get the input from everybody. And there might be a reason why that person is very uncomfortable with whatever that rule might be. So it's important to get everyone's feedback.
Well, and I also want to throw this out, too, because I think that what we found, at least, is for some of the folks in our project, what they found when they really started bringing everybody together and really talking about the rules, where they come from, can we get rid of it, can't we get rid of it, this kind of thing, what they also found is that, because Deidre, I totally, this is my life's work. And much like you described, you know, we do this work because we're passionate about it and we, you know, we want to end violence. I mean, that's what we do. And I think what some folks found is not everybody within their organizations, including advocates, not everybody felt that way. I think there were a lot of conversations around, okay, we do have folks that this is not their life's work. They came here not to, you know, not thinking, oh, I'm gonna take this job because I want to be mean to people. Not that, but more like, I really need a job. I think this would be something I might like to do. And I think that was kind of a shift for some administrators that we were talking with. They didn't realize that that's really what was happening in some of the programs. And so I do throw that out there as, you know, as folks are thinking about this and listening to it, is you might not have some folks in every position that this is their life's work. And what does that mean when you are training around the history of this work, around, you know, what does that mean for your organization?
Yeah, that's a really good point, Laura. And then, you know, the other thing I think that comes to mind as you were talking is that the reality in shelters, as we all know too well, is staff turnover is incredibly high.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we get to a place in our organizations and that we've institutionalized kind of this way in which staff who have worked in shelter for a long time and they become comfortable with the rules and they understand the realities and complexity of Better Women's Lives, and so they make the rules work because they're experienced and they can understand them in a different way, not black and white for how it's written on the piece of paper, right? And so that's when the actual practice of the rule changes or they become negotiable, is because that experience of those who work in shelter feel confident and comfortable to be able to do that. But when we have turnover, most of the time when we have a brand new staff person who's never worked in shelter before, this could possibly be their very first job out of college, you know, wherever we land in our programs of staffing, all of those nuances are missed because they're not institutionalized in how we do our work within our organizations. And so all of that then suddenly changes when key staff people leave. And all of a sudden you have this very different feel in your shelter instantaneously. And it's not palatable on how that happened until you start dissecting, well, gosh, now we're just enforcing the rules that are written And so it's another really good reason to just start exploring and diving into what is it that we really want to have on paper so that we don't have this attrition of new staff coming in, doing something different, figuring out that it really doesn't work for women's lives, that doesn't account for this, this, and this, and this is what I do instead. That takes a long time to get to that place of comfort and knowing and not fearful of what happens if I don't follow the rules as a staff person and all of those pieces.
Well, and Beth, I wish that I could say what we found was that it was only as there was staff turnover and new staff. There was some really painful, painful conversations around, like, long-time staff at programs that when they really started going through this, they were like, oh, my gosh, I don't think they're going to make it.
There is one, this is Jennifer, there is one executive director of a program who their program wasn't in this project, but, you know, everybody was talking about it, and, you know, her philosophy was, you know, to set people up for success, you know, the world has rules. Everybody has to adhere to rules, so we really need to replicate that in our program so that people know how to operate in the world. Versus looking at it as this should be their time for respite, this should be their time for healing. You know, we operate our program, so we don't have to have rules because the rest of the world does. It's this is their place and their time to be able to heal and work through things. So, yeah, we heard it from people who had been around for a long time.
This is Deidre, Beth. I would add that at New Beginnings, and I can only speak for New Beginnings because this is where I've put most of my energy in this agency, but I find that it's very important to not have so much turnover. What's important to me is to work with advocates and let them know that they're more than just an advocate and that when you come to New Beginnings, it's an exchange for me. I'm going to get something from you, and you're going to get something from me, but I can't help you get what you want unless I don't know what you really want. So do you want to know how to do support groups, public speaking? What? Tell me what you want. Do you want to teach kids? Tell me what you want to do, because I find that advocates sort of get stuck behind the desk providing a service where they're monitoring rules, monitoring people. They don't always see a lot of success. And it can be very, very depressing and down and not feel successful at the end of their shift, end of their week, end of their month. And we all know that these jobs don't come with a lot of perks, so you have to find ways to support staff and bring out the best in them. So give them opportunities to speak in the community, table events, do a support group, go on, whatever it might be, but pull out their extra talents so that they can show that they can do more than just follow and give rules out to people and not feel that successful at the end of the day.
Absolutely.
And you can also support them in that process, and then they'll want to stay longer. If they're invested because they have a voice in the agency, if they're invested because they're feeling they're making a difference in the agency, everyone wins. But if they don't feel that, if they don't get the sense that there's an investment, there's a place for them there, they won't stay, and they won't want to build, and they won't want to grow. And even if it's for a year or 2 years that you get something out of that person and they get something out of you, you both won.
Yeah, this is Jennifer. That was very eloquent because it is part of it is what sort of training and mentoring are we providing to staff so that they really understand the impact of their work. You know, we had talked to someone recently who there had been some issues at their program, and the person answering the phone didn't realize, you know, the idea was, well, I just answer the phone versus I answer the hotline, which is a critical link to our program, and I'm the first response that somebody has to whether or not they're going to access services. And those are absolutely things that we can be building up in our program so that staff understand the importance of their work and what a difference that it can end up making to someone.
Yeah, I can't say enough about how important what you all just said was, is the recognition that staff need different things. And so I wanted to take us back. I know when, Laura, you were talking, you had a chance to talk a little bit about identifying core values, but I want to take us back just a little bit and dissect that just a little bit more about why that's so important and what identifying core values can help with in this process, both of making sure that as a collective staff, we understand and feel good about the work that we do in the capacity, whatever capacity we do. And then more importantly, when we're looking to start making programmatic changes, why that is so important as kind of this underlying pin of exploration.
Yeah, so this is Laura, and I really, it really does go back to, though, why we do what we do. And so it's really, it is examining those, it's examining those kinds of things so that everybody does know, and that staff does feel connected, they feel supported, they know why, you know, we're doing what we're doing. And if we really look at those things, you know, empowerment, self-determination, respite, transition, you know, strengths of somebody, when we really start to look at those things and start to go, okay, this is where we're coming from with our program, you know, are our services, our practices, is it inclusive? I mean, that's another piece of this too, and in really being able to look at all of those things and be able to, well, to know why we do what we do, and to really be able to partner with somebody else. And I mean, we get such a small snippet of somebody's life, and it really is being able to work with somebody, you know, side by side, and help them on this piece of their journey that we actually do have the privilege to be a part of, and really being able to look at, again, back down to those core values of why we do what we do, and does it really go back to our mission? Does it meet our vision, our philosophies? You know, and is or you know, do what we have, some of the things going right now, or is it in conflict to it? I mean, I think that in talking about supporting staff in particular, if they are not feeling good about some of the things they're having to do but don't really have a place to be able to talk about that and ask questions about that, I mean, I think you're going to see also just a lot of conflict among staff too. I don't know if that's kind of where you were going with that or if that's helpful at all.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. Hey, just a tech thing, your speakerphone is giving us a little feedback, so you're echoing a little bit.
I'll turn it
down. I know that you and Jennifer are in the same room sharing the same speakerphone. Just maybe if you could pick it up and use a handset and then go back, maybe just that act of reconnecting might eliminate it. But, yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking,
yeah.
You know.
Beth, this is Deidre, and I guess I would just add to that, you know, I think every day to myself when I do this work that I'm making a difference in people's lives. I'm making a difference around the world. I'm doing work that is changing, that is supporting, that is reaching out to help others. If I didn't feel that way about the work that I do, then I need to reevaluate what I'm doing. And if the staff and your agency doesn't feel like they're doing work that's making a difference, then that's a discussion that should be had.
Yeah, Deidre, I totally agree, and I think that is where some of the programs that we were working with, I think that's exactly what they found themselves doing, and really, really looking at, well, number one, and I say this in trainings that I do, is this is not, being an advocate, working in a domestic violence shelter is not for everyone. And that's okay. People can still be a part of this movement and be a part of changing the world, but not actually having to provide direct services within a shelter program. And so I think, though, there were a lot of discussions that were trying to, it was to really examine, okay, why are we here and what are we doing?
And this is Beth. There's because that piece is important, you know, to hold individually for yourself why I'm here and know what I'm doing. And then I think that maybe we could explore just a little bit of the second layer of happening, of all of our collective values together that create what we do as an organization collectively. Because there's power in knowing that we all share the same or similar values to the work that we do. And so I don't know if you want to speak to kind of that collective understanding and what that can do and how that shapes then moving forward. Or not. We don't have to talk about that.
This is Laura. I was trying to actually figure out if I had anything. I do think it's important, but Beth, I'll be real honest with you. I think that it's going to be a much longer and larger conversation in which we have to actually talk about where we are as a movement right now, and are we actually a collective at this moment? You know, are we inclusive as a movement at this moment? Are we actually talking about and really dismantling racism and oppression? I mean, so I think it's a bigger conversation that I hope I haven't necessarily opened a can of worms, but I'm not sure that it's something that can be overly condensed easily on this call.
No, I think you're exactly right. I mean, there's this bigger question of collectively where are we as a movement that we've brought up an awful lot within the ALC and kind of our bigger conversations. And I don't know that we have time to go down that path right at this moment, but mostly what I was thinking of is if, as an organization sitting listening to this call who has kind of this desire to move down a path of exploring their shelter rules, and we have touched on the fact that having people understand why they've come to this work and what they do, I'm just wondering if there would be value and importance to then collectively all of us as an organization coming together to understand as an organization what we value and why we do what we do so that we have this framework.
Yeah, this is Jennifer. I think that's always important, especially with this project, but with anything else, for people to feel connected to that and to still go back to them.
So is there a way that, I don't want to put the three of you on the spot, and maybe there isn't a, you know, a quick answer to this, but have there been organizations that you worked with within your coalition that have gone through this process, and do you have a way in which you could present a easy way, or easy, that's probably the biggest understatement of the world, but a way in which somebody could replicate doing that? Because it seems daunting.
Explain doing that a little bit more. Do you mean like...
How would you sit with all of the staff within the organization to come to an understanding of your collective core values that you all hold as an organization?
So this is Deidre. What we do, what Margaret and I do actually, is we go to different cities and we do this whole training on shelter rules. And a big part of our training is around core values. And so who we invite to the table are advocates, managers, and executive directors. And all the programs in that particular community, town, region, they all come together. So they have an opportunity to hear what other agencies are doing and what their core values are and how they implement those in their programs. And they also talk about the rules that they have and the rules that they don't have. So everyone is privileged to everyone's information. Now, I have to say, not every agency that we've brought together has always worked well together. But once we pulled them together and they started talking and they started sharing information, it was like the light bulb came on. And people did not realize how much resources and how much similarities there were in their programs until we all came together. And it really got people thinking about like, what are our core values? What sets the tone for the work that we do every day? What does that look like? How can we spell that out so we can actually work by this core value? And so we put everybody out in the room. They put up their core values, and we talked about them out loud, and we discussed them. So you've got like 8 to 10 programs all from all over that county coming together that might not have actually talked before, but now they're all talking. And it is, I mean, you have executive directors as well, and it is amazing how it unfolds and it comes together in the end. And Margaret and I can come to your city if you want us to.
How cool is that? I mean, what power. That's an amazing experience. And I must say you're very brave for doing that, because I've had the experience of that going very wrong.
Well, and you're right. I have actually had executive directors that definitely have challenged me on the floor, but by the end of the 2 days, we're all in love. And I don't know how I managed to do it, but it's really just about thinking, and it's about pushing people. And we tell people at the very beginning of the conference, we say, we're going to push you, and you're going to be uncomfortable, but it's all about learning who you are and where you want to be. And that's the whole point of it. It's like, it's going to hurt, it's going to be painful, you're probably not going to be happy, and we work it out. We work it out. But the executive directors, we do breakout sessions where we just work with the executive directors and we sort of push them. And then we work with advocates, because we all know that some advocates don't want to actually say things in front of their managers and executive directors. And so we recognize that, and we support that process to figure out how we can bring them all together in the end. And that's what we do.
And yeah. This is Jennifer. Because reducing shelter rules is really a part of trauma-informed care, I mean, it's got to be an ongoing way of how we do things. I mean, it's not like one specific service. It's really changing how we approach. And so whether it's an initial training that gets that conversation going, whether it's something that you're going back to at staff meetings, because depending on how large your program is, it's really hard to have everybody together. So it's going to be an ongoing conversation. It may be even thinking about, you know, hopefully the program is having staff meetings, but I do know some programs haven't. And so being able to connect with folks is having regular staff meetings, sometimes even changing the times of the staff meetings so that, you know, it makes it easier some weeks for nighttime workers to be able to attend, so that there's ways to be able to continue these conversations throughout the week and the month. It's even one-on-one supervision time, you know, supervisors with their advocates, or just, you know, even if it's not a supervisor, an advocate that's been around a long time who really gets it, being able to mentor to others. Some of those things really help in terms of that implementation, but it will take a while, and things will come up, and having your mission statement available to be able to reflect on, whether it's on a wall or close nearby, to be able to have that process of going back to it.
This is Deidre. You're absolutely right, because part of the training that we do at near the end is how to have conversations between advocates and managers and directors, and then back the other way, directors to managers and managers to advocates, and how that process can be supported in a healthy way so that everyone has a voice and feels safe to have that voice. So we have a little piece on that as well.
Yeah, that's really good, because that is what gets in the way oftentimes, is not feeling like you can effectively communicate what it is that, or feel safe to communicate what it is that you need to say about things. I also heard you say just a little bit earlier, and I heard Laura and Jennifer talk about this briefly at the last call, but kind of that willingness to be okay to be uncomfortable for a little while. I'm wondering if we could just talk about that for just a minute, because that's easier said than done. And why is that important to kind of put that out there?
Well, you know, when we bring everyone to the table, the tension is already there, because we've invited advocates, managers, and directors. And so it starts out with, we already are aware that some people probably aren't going to say much because their managers are there, and advocates are not going to say, you know, I stayed at my job 8 hours doing XYZ and I didn't get any recognition for that. They're not going to say that. Although it might be affecting them tremendously, they're not going to have that conversation then. And so our hope is that we guide people to be able to have conversations about the things that really impact advocates providing advocacy. And we realize that when rules are in place and advocates are dictating rules on a regular basis and it becomes the majority of their work, that that's not the best work environment. But who do they talk to about that? The rules are already set. They got the job. They walk in, and they're told, this is your job description, and this is what you're going to do. How do they know they can challenge that? How do they know they have a voice? How do they know they're going to feel safe to have that voice? So that's kind of what we talk about, is we're gonna push this to a level where we want people to speak their minds, be able to say what they want to say, and we're going to work it out. And it becomes – it's a little challenging, but it moves everyone to a different place, because we start to understand where are the problems, where the problems lie, and what those problems create for the people that are doing the work. That part is never discussed. It's just about, we have this role play where we, you know, we have two advocates coming together, and they talk about, no one wants to be on call. No one wants to be on call because there's this problem, you know, participant in the house, and they don't want to be on call, but someone has to be on call. Who do they have that discussion with? No one wants to be called at midnight about the person in room A. So it's and how that impacts you in your life, in your personal life, and how can we move forward with that? We're not, the person's not calling the executive director, they're not calling the manager, they're calling the advocate, and discussing the impact that has on them. And it's just challenging. It's challenging work in shelters, and it's challenging work when you have communal living, and it's even more challenging when you have 20 rules to go by. And it's just not the best work environment. So we just talk about that.
Yeah, perfect.
And
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think that executive directors often, you know, from a distance, they look at it and think, oh, it's just working. Everything's working. Going good, woohoo, thumbs up, but not recognizing the impact that setting rules and having rules is having on participants that are coming to the program, and having on staff being the ones that have to issue out these rules every day. And once that dialogue starts to happen, it just opens up so many windows. It opens up so much conversation and so much dialogue that, you know, directors are like, I didn't know we had that rule. Why do we have that rule? And so it just opens the conversation.
Yeah, and Deidre, you just actually said part of what I was going to talk about too there was, you're absolutely right. Often often an executive director administrator may not even know that that rule was created.
Right.
Or why or anything else. But, you know, really what we're talking about too is it's really – changing culture within the organization. It's changing,
yes,
that, you know, in how we communicate, and how we work with each other, and how we support each other. And, you know, when you start to change culture, yeah, for some people that's going to be really uncomfortable. But it is a never-ending process, but eventually you do start to see those changes take place. And you continue to work, but as the culture changes, it doesn't mean you have to stop working on it, but it shifts into working in other ways with things too. But there is, what I really hope is that as folks start to maybe talk more about it and go through the process, is that they don't lose that piece about, we really need to learn how to communicate with each other, how to support each other, how to challenge each other in a way that doesn't shut people down, and really, because so much of this really does depend upon communication.
Right. Beth, I want to add to that too. One thing we ask people to do is to take their own rules and ask yourself, if you were in your program, could you follow those rules? Or would you have to lie to navigate around those rules just so you could stay? And if you're lying to navigate around those rules, then what? How does that make you feel? And then if an advocate finds out you're lying, what does that mean for your stay? So just take your rules for a minute and put yourself in someone's shoes and just think, you know, if I walked in that door and they said to me, you know, give me, you have to turn over your purse and your car keys and your wallet and I need your ID, would you do it? Would you turn over your debit card and your phone? Would you give it to them because that's their rule and you have to turn it in? Or would you say, oh, you know, I never carry a wallet. Oh, I didn't get my driver's license. I don't have one. And I don't have any credit cards, so you can't have that. I mean, like, our mouths would probably come up with every excuse not to turn over any of those items. So that makes us, now we're lying. And now we have to keep up that lie. And we hope they don't find out because we don't want to be asked to leave. So what, when someone walks into the door of your program, what tone do you set for when they walk into that program? And could you live by that?
We do the same thing, or we did the same process with documentation and, like, intake forms, is we ask folks to, you know, sit across from each other and, mm-hmm. you know, do an intake with somebody that's, you know, like your coworker. And we found so many people that were so incredibly uncomfortable when they had to answer their own intake form.
Yes. Well, that's one of the questions that we ask in our training is, how do you feel about people who lie that come to your program?
Mm-hmm.
It's quite amazing what we hear back from people. The continuum in the room goes from, oh, no one could ever lie to me and they will have to go, to I could care less if someone lied to me. And it's amazing to have that conversation in a huge room with a lot of people so everyone can understand that impact on others.
Well, and I love that question, by the way, is how do you feel when someone lies to you? And it does, it reminds me, too, of some of, like, the interview questions for hiring people that the folks that were participating in our project, they started changing how they hire people in those interview questions. And one of my favorites has to do with how do you, or why do you think, why it's, we serve many low-income families through the shelter. Why do you think people are poor?
Yeah.
You know, our community is becoming more diverse. What opportunities and challenges do you think diversity brings to our community? You know, tell your thoughts about people with addictions. Tell your thoughts about people with mental illness. And they really, when they started to hire, had to hire new staff or whatever, I mean, they really started looking at what questions are we asking to get to some of maybe what are core values for people already that may not match with what we hope are our core values within our work.
Well, actually, at the recent training that we held, one of our members talked about, she even during the interview talks about, you know, they have this reduced rule philosophy and goes into a little bit and gauges feedback from the interviewee. And she said she had somebody recently that she just knew it wasn't going to be a good fit.
So I'm going to bring us back to our exploration of shelter rules just in terms of being able to sustain this work. 'Cause Laura, I think you brought it up around this changing culture piece as this first kind of way in which I think is important to start to explore this and sustain it. And so I'm wondering if there's a way that we can talk about what your suggestions are for how we sustain keeping our examination of shelter rules going and what it is that makes this successful.
Well, I know that for us, and again, you know, these things definitely came out of the programs that were part of the original project. And, I mean, it, like I said, in the last call, it started in 2007. And these folks are continuing to do this, and obviously throughout the state, more and more people have been examining the rules. And, I mean, some of the things that they truly talk about are around, you know, being able to support staff. You know, looking at when they do have to hire for positions, changing how they're doing, you know, what questions they're asking and how they're doing that, what type of, you know, training they're providing for staff, and not just one time, but what's ongoing training, what's ongoing support, how they are really coaching and mentoring, you know, does staff have the ability to really be able to talk to each other, and if there are concerns, you know, is it an environment in which they can express those? You know, there's some horrible things that we hear every day, and so many different things that we are trying to, you know, work with somebody, and you know that whether, you know, whether it's vicarious trauma or whatever you want to call it, you know, are we really being able to support staff through that? Are they able to take care of themselves, and are we supportive in that? I know that one of the programs, as far as, and I know there's more to this than sustaining it just through staff, but that's a big part of it. But I know one of the programs has actually started basically what I'm going to call like a wellness committee, I think is what they've referred to it as. And within their program, I mean, there are incentives for, well, I think things like, you know, making sure that you do take all of your vacation days, that you do, you know, they also have set up even like a gym within the program that, you know, if you want to set goals for yourself on, I don't know, working out or whatever it is. But, I mean, there's all kinds of things in which it's really looking at the wellness, you know, the wellness of the individual.
Because that will help the advocates in responding to situations. You know, when they're taking this stuff on and they're feeling in crisis, then it's harder for them to problem solve, and it's much easier than to react of, well, there's a rule, this is what we do, versus being able to be at a calmer place and being able to really process all the situations that they're working through. So this really is meant to be something that's both helpful for the survivors we're working with as well as staff, so that they don't get burned out and leave, that those who really are passionate about this and buy into this work, that they're able to get what they need to be able to continue it. Because even the best advocate can also turn into a really cranky advocate when they've taken on way too much.
True, and you know, one thing that keeps me, this is Deidre, that keeps me motivated every day is that I know that I'm making a difference out in the world. I know that I'm helping families and children move forward. I know that I'm giving back. And, you know, I work in Washington, and you know we have Microsoft, we have Starbucks, we have Boeing, and I always say to my friends, did you give back today? Probably not. And it just, you know, I think to myself, I'm doing something that's making a difference, and I love that. People I know are saying, gosh, I need to find a cause. I do it every day. I'm giving back every day, and it motivates me. It gives me energy, and I do it to the best of my ability. And what the reward for that is I know that I made a difference in someone's life, and I'm doing that effectively, and I'm helping others do it as well. And if you're not passionate about it, but if you're not supported in that process, that needs to be part of the discussion, because you can hire people, you can train people, you can try to coach them, you can meet with them, but if they don't feel like they're making a difference, if they don't feel like they have a voice in the process of the work they're doing, there's a gap there.
Yeah, absolutely. I also, you know, just as far as sustainability in general throughout the organization too, you know, there's also been a lot of work around, you know, really, it's like, you know, aside from now having more regular kind of staff meetings, but it really is looking at the opportunities for the women and children in shelter as well, of like, are we really, you know, when somebody calls on the hotline or when somebody, you know, is looking for shelter and has accessed the service in whatever way it is, are we really being honest up front with somebody, too, about potentially what it is like here, you know, kind of thing? And it was really a much more about open and honest conversations around people who were also wanting to access services. I mean, there was that aspect of it, too. It was really interesting to me how there was a lot of work that needed to be done around how do you have a conversation with somebody. And I found that fascinating, because I was like, when did we stop learning how to talk to each other and listen to each other?
Right.
That was a really weird phenomena to me, where, And it was like, because that whole idea of like, well, if I don't have this rule and I've got to have a conversation with somebody, well, what's that conversation look like? And there was a lot of work we had to do around that. And I think it's work that has to continue within the program too. Again, that communication and what does that look like? Also, you know, let's face it. And I think it goes back to what Deidre was talking about earlier with what's the insides even look like? What's the outside of the shelter look like? You know, what's the kitchen set up? What's the bedroom set up? Because so many conflicts that do occur in a program have to do often with certain things of just the design of the building, and also communal living types of. I mean, we're asking a group of strangers who have been in crisis to live together. I mean, this isn't a natural and normal situation, you know. And so one of the executive directors who was in on this original project made a comment, and it stuck with me, and I love it when she says it. She was like, why are we so surprised that women in crisis act like they're in crisis? And so it's also remembering and recognizing that, and how do we work with, you know, how do we work with people in crisis? And to me, it seems like sometimes it's such a basic level, but I think that's sometimes where we stumble the hardest is when things are at those things like, how do you have a conversation? Well, of course people in crisis are going to act like they're in crisis. You know, I mean, sometimes it is very back to the basics, which is what I think that our project here really was it's like we're taking this back to the very beginning of when there were actually no shelters, where there were no rules. This was somebody called me on the phone and said, my best friend is in a really bad situation. I know you've got an extra bedroom. Do you think maybe she and her kid, I don't know, maybe could stay with you for a few days until things kind of calm down? I mean, this is like back to true basics in my head.
Yeah, Laura, this is exactly where Anne Menard started our conversation. The first part of the series was where did we start, kind of our historical perspective, and you're exactly right. That's kind of where this started from, and somehow along the way we lost it a little bit. Before I continue, I just want to interject to please encourage anyone who wants to share a comment or a thought or a question to push *1, and the operator will get you in to an unmuted line so you can talk with us, or quick send me an email, advocacy@praxisinternational.org, and I'll pop it in for you. But, you know, I think that this whole concept around not knowing how to have a conversation is really important to recognize that that's a reality of a lot of what we have been faced with. And it's a hard reality to hear, and we don't necessarily want to know that that's really what people struggle with. But I think all too often when we insert forms or insert pages and pages of rules that we're expecting advocates to go over with women and have this expectation that everybody would agree to all of these rules before we, you know, have women come in, that's one of those pieces that is the first to deteriorate our ability to just have a conversation and a dialogue with women, because we can't connect in a real way, and we can't possibly envision ourselves having a conversation about what her experiences are and what it is that she needs when we feel the pressure to have to convey very particular information. And so that's the rub. It just happens because we've created kind of this expectation of what would happen before *2 happens. So I think that that's an important thing for us to remember, and I'm glad you brought it up. It's a hard thing for programs to give up, because then what do you rely on?
Yeah, and this is, you know, that's one of the things, too, as far as that sustainability piece. when we take, for the right reasons or not, when we take something away, like a rule, like a form, if we remove those, though, it really is looking at, okay, if that's how I'm used to doing this and that's how I, you know, what do I do instead? So it really is, when we do start to remove things, I really do think it breaks down the barriers of being able to really be, you know, an advocate with, you know, with somebody and partnering with somebody. But at the same time, what are we giving somebody? What tool are we giving them to use? And it is things like, oh, conversation. But again, if that is not the way that the organization's been running, you can't just expect, I don't think it's realistic to suspect that it's all just going to be okay because we took this away. We're going to have to do some work if that's the culture that's been set.
Yeah. And then again, it goes back to the statement that's been said a couple of times, that willingness to be uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. That's going to be one of those moments where we're all going to be uncomfortable for a little while because something happens that's different. And change is hard, whether it's change for the better or we're struggling with the change. It does create this feeling of uncomfortableness. And sometimes when we're uncomfortable, we retreat back to the known. And I think we have to be willing to be uncomfortable and stick together to say, we're willing to be uncomfortable. How can we support each other in being uncomfortable for these moments? And then what it is that we need to do to alleviate that feeling so that we are in a comfortable space. But I've heard you loud and clear over the, you know, particularly the last call when we were diving into the nitty-gritty of what are we looking at. It became really evident that the programs that kind of signed up with you all to take on this project really did move through a process where lots of change happened in a pretty fast amount of time when you really think about it. It took them years to get to the place where they were when they came down and sat down at that first meeting, and, you know, within a short period of time, there was a lot of different things happening within each of those organizations. It was pretty powerful.
And they will all report, every last one of them will report kind of this mass amounts of chaos for the first few months. And then things started to settle down a little bit, if you will, and they kind of found their groove. But they still to this day, 6 years later, are still calling, going, hey, this has kind of come up, you know, any suggestions? Because, again, it's not something that you can just, I don't know. You just have to continue. It's a continual. It's just a continual kind of process.
Mass amounts of chaos. That's scary.
Right. This is Deirdre. It is definitely something that you have to work towards. And some things are going to take longer than others. And one thing that I say in my training is that, you know, don't be surprised of the big changes that you can make quickly, sitting in a room with your staff in an hour or two. There are things that you can do, changes that you can make that can happen very, very quickly. But then there are other ones that are going to take time. And so to recognize that, you know, you'll have some success in the beginning, but you'll also have some things that just don't feel that very comfortable. But, you know, you just keep pushing along with it, and you'll find your groove. Like you said, you'll find that groove, and you'll figure out what's working and what's not working. But some things will come easy, and some things will be a little more of a challenge.
The funny part about that mass chaos I was talking about, that was with staff.
Yeah.
It wasn't about folks that were in shelter. The folks that were in shelter, the thing about this whole chaos thing, it was like things were not any worse or any better as they were making the changes, except staff had so much more anxiety.
Well, and there was one staff person who, you know, she was used to sitting in her office and folks coming to her, and when the appointments weren't mandated, she didn't know what to do, and it was, well, maybe you could go out and hang out with them and watch TV and start talking to them. Maybe you can go say hello to them. You've got to rethink how you're doing something.
So, yeah, it was much more about staff, I think, chaos. But basically, you know, shelter life was kind of the same, I think. And in the long run, and I know we haven't talked, like, rule right now, and we did more of that in the last one, I think, a little bit. But, you know, things like getting, you know, the shelter wasn't any cleaner or any dirtier when they started getting rid of chore rules. The, you know, there weren't any more people that were coming in after curfew, you know, or staying out all night or whatever it was when they got rid of curfew. So, I mean, it was really looking at, as they started to get rid of things, it really wasn't changing that much as far as what was happening internally with just the process kind of stuff. What was happening, though, is the change in being able to really work with somebody and be able to be an advocate. And what does that mean? And what does it look like with the relationships that we're building? And how we're able to work with somebody, and partner with somebody. That's where the change was, really, how to be an advocate. That's where the change took place.
Perfect. Hey, I'm going to interrupt us for a question that I'm wondering if Stephanie could put through for us. Stephanie, are you able to put?
Hello?
Hello?
Okay, their line was open, but they didn't say anything. Just give me one moment, Beth.
Okay.
Deaf Unity, your line is now open.
Hello?
Deaf Unity, your line is now open.
Yes, I'm here, but nobody can hear me.
Oh, we can hear you now. Sorry for that technical glitch.
Oh, yay. Can you hear? You can hear me.
I can, yes.
Oh, fabulous. Okay. This is a little hard to get on, but I'm on. So I know I only have a very few minutes, but I've been trying to kind of break in to just, I'd feel remiss if I didn't try to connect with you. And just, I was going to ask a question regarding, you're talking about shelter rules, you're talking about a level of people being comfortable or not, and I mean, I'm sitting here as an advocate for deaf victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, and one of our big thrusts here in Wisconsin for Deaf Unity is to focus on co-advocacy, and what does that mean, what does it look like? How can it be a win-win on all situations on behalf of the victim who is looking for the support? And I'm finding it kind of interesting to try to move forward with this co-advocacy relationship, because when a third-party advocate, I call it a third-party advocate, walks into a shelter for victims of domestic violence and or sexual assault, I'm finding that there's people don't get it, and it's really hard for us to explain what our purpose is, and that we're not there to take over, we're not there to do their job, we're not there to contribute in any kind of deficit or negative way that takes away from what a shelter is doing. But I find it a bit of a can of worms that we're experiencing in trying to proactively bring our advocacy expertise into the realm of another entity that already has a level of expertise and work together. So I'm just wondering, in the last half a minute that you have left, if somebody could say something about that whole concept of, you know, co-advocacy and shelters and rules, and is there something that somebody can offer as advice as to how to approach this? And does anybody else have that experience? I'm done.
Thank you. Sorry, it was so hard for you to get through. Laura, Jennifer, Deidre, do you have a thought?
Well, this is Deidre. I guess what I can add is that in Seattle, we did have some difficulty when it came to mental health providers and DV advocates, and we didn't always necessarily see the things that each other was doing to support our participants. And so what we decided to do was come together and create a curriculum that supported both of our programs that focused on helping people that were coming to both of our services to receive services. So that's been a long work in progress, and we're still continuing to do it. And I can't tell you how much education we received about the mental health community that we did not even know, that created barriers for us. So no matter what program it is, whether it's the deaf community, whether it's someone with different languages or religious beliefs, you have to connect. You have to understand each other's language, understand, you know, where each program is coming from, and learn how to respect that and work with that. But if you don't come together, it's really, really hard to do.
Am I still on?
Yes. You are.
Yes.
I am. I just thank you so much for that. And I do want to say, I mean, we've had some lovely success here in Wisconsin with some domestic violence programs, and it's because we are moving forward very small baby steps at a time, but we're doing exactly what you just said. We've had a committee. We're working on joint protocol. We're working on understanding each other's protocol, what our goals are, what our missions are. You know, we're really working hard to shake hands with each other. But it's really interesting that when a deaf victim shows up on the doorstep of a domestic violence program and shelter, no matter all the handshaking and all the understanding and the growth of information that everybody's gaining, everything can kind of freeze and go back to zero, you know, and that's just something that we're all trying to get on the same page with. And it's a slow process, but I totally appreciate what you said, and we're working very hard at making this a win-win situation for everyone. So thanks for listening.
Well, thanks for being very persistent, Veronica, and trying to get through. So,
Okay.
So we're coming to the end of our 90 minutes. It goes like warp speed. So I just wanted to give Jennifer, Laura, and Deidre just a final moment to say any closing thoughts or remarks that they have.
I just want to add really quickly, this Deidre, that the King County Coalition in Washington State is the program that designed building the relationship between mental health services and domestic violence services. So if you want to go to their website, it's the King County Coalition Against Domestic Violence website, and I think they have some information about the project that they did.
Perfect. We'll post that link, too, so it's easy for people to find. Thanks, Deidre.
Yes.
Laura, Jennifer?
This is Jennifer, and I'm sure this is Laura would probably say something similar, that there's really just no one right answer. Like, that's part of why we still get phone calls from programs, thinking through different situations. You know, it's like with a safety plan, you change one thing and suddenly you've got to reconceptualize what somebody's options are. And, it's, you know, we get a lot of these what if this questions, but there's no one answer for every single situation. It's just being able to have patience and support and address each one as uniquely.
Yeah, and I just, thank you for the opportunity to be able to talk about this. And it's something that, you know, I hope we continue to talk about. And I really, Deidre, I so appreciate how many times you've reminded all of us too about, you know, this is work in which we actually do get an opportunity to change the world. And I hope that nobody does forget that, because not everybody can say that.
Thank you. That's so nice. I think, you know, that when you're supported in your agency and you know that you have a voice in your agency and you have a voice in your community, it motivates you and it keeps you going. And that we all have to stay connected, whether it's going to county meetings and coalition meetings and, you know, whatever it might be, monthly meetings, whatever you, advocacy, all advocates get together and have a meeting. I don't care what it is. You got to find that support. You got to get out there and stay connected. And your agency has to support you. And I think that is so important and detrimental to the people who are coming to our programs. They're walking into our programs and they don't know what they're walking into. But what are we presenting to them when they come to our program? And that's what we need to be discussing. What are people getting when they come to our agencies? Are we happy about that? Are we satisfied with what we're providing to our community?
Very nice. My goodness, women. I'm so impressed and so sad that our 90 minutes went so quickly because we could spend hours talking with you. So thank you. You've been very gracious with your time, and we are very happy that you spent time with us on this three-part series. It's been fascinating conversations to be able to finally explore this. I know many people have been asking, many programs have been asking, can we please just dive into shelter rules for a little while? So hopefully for those of you who are asking, this met your needs and you are able to take these conversations we had together and bring them back to your community and start those important conversations. We hope they keep going. We will try to continue to support you in any way we can. And we also wanted to say our affinity discussions are a little different than our strategy sessions, as you have seen. It gives us an opportunity to take up a narrow topic, or sometimes not so narrow topic, but a very specific topic, and delve into it a little bit more than we would on any one particular call. And so this is your opportunity to bring up things that you want to have dove into and have a little bit of time to explore together. So if you have something that you want to talk about, I'd be happy to take those suggestions and see if we can create a call around them. So please email me at any time your suggestions for things that would be helpful for you to bring up in an affinity discussion format. My email is advocacy@praxisinternational.org as a little reminder. So please do that, or you know, feel free to pick up the phone and call me. We can have a little conversation about what it is that you need that would be helpful for you all. So again, thank you, Deidre, Laura, and Jennifer, for spending time with us on this call. And this does conclude our three-part series. All of the recordings will be on the website. So for all of you who, particularly class, I realized as I was introducing you that you didn't get a chance because you weren't a part of the ALC yet to even listen to part one and two. So this is a little out of context for all of you who didn't have any background or preparation for why in the world we would be talking about shelter rules, just kind of out of the blue. So hopefully you caught on throughout the conversation and you can go back and listen to those first two, and hopefully that will help you put it all together. So we appreciate your time, and there will be evaluations coming out very quickly in your inbox. So we would appreciate having your quick feedback. It doesn't take very long, but we really do value your opinion. So take a little bit of time there. Liz, is there any other announcements that you want to share?
No, the only other thing really is that the next affinity discussion will be Thursday, November 7th, and that will be for classes G, H, and I. Class F will just have graduated. So we're happy for Class F. We're sad to be losing them, but for the rest of us, the next affinity discussion will be the beginning of November. So thank you to our speakers and our participants, and everybody have a good day.
Great. This officially ends our call. Thanks, everybody. Have a great
day. Thank you.